Good evening, everyone. Hey, you guys are with it more tonight than you were last night. I heard one the first time, and I heard everybody almost tonight. It is good to see each and every one of you here here for a second night of Bible studies. How many of you enjoyed our Bible study last night? Wasn't that good? I really, really enjoyed the approach towards Daniel chapter 2 last night. Daniel chapter 2 is a great chapter to look at. And, every time I go through and look at it, I always learn something new and fresh. And isn't that one of the neat things about studying the Bible? That no matter how many times we've read through something, God will reveal something to us fresh and new as we go through this. Do you know how many Daniel chapter 2s have been published since printing became a big thing? There have been something like 6 billion Bibles published. And so 6 billion Daniel chapter 2s have been published as well. And even with so many different people having access to this and reading it, it's so neat that God can inspire us afresh as we read through it and study it again. So this is only night number 2. There's a whole lot more stuff that we're going to get to study together as a group. And I think it's fun when we do this together. Studying by ourselves is a good thing. But it's also really awesome for us to come together and to study corporately as a group and to learn together. And that's one of the benefits of coming together to a series like this. And so I hope that you will continue to enjoy the studies that we go through for the next couple weeks. And tonight we have another great topic. And I hope that you have a Bible close by. If not, there's one in the back of the seat there in front of you, and you can follow along with our study. If you have a Bible at home, a favorite Bible, bring it tomorrow night so you can follow along and you can highlight and underline maybe some of the key texts that we'll be going through and studying. I have several different Bibles that I use. And I always have a pen with me. Some people have, they're really organized with their highlighting, and there's color-coded highlights and color-coded underlining. Anybody use color-coded stuff when they are studying? A couple of you are very organized. I have a plain old Bic pen, and I try and make a straight line, and hopefully it doesn't slant at the end as I'm listening for the next bit. But if you have a favorite Bible, bring it tomorrow night, and maybe bring your favorite highlighter or your favorite pen, and you'll want to underline some of these things so that you can go back and look at them a little bit later on in your own personal studies. So I hope that you're going to enjoy our study tonight. I want to invite Ty to come up and to kick us off with our study this evening. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, good evening, everyone. Let me set my trusty timer. Tonight, I'm going to ask you to do something with me that you may or may not want to do. I have a friend who invited me over some time ago, and as I entered the house to just hang out for a little bit, his wife approached me with a platter covered with what she called bite-sized blueberry muffins. She said, "Would you like one?" I said, "Of course. I love blueberries with my muffin so that I can trick myself into thinking it's a health food, you know what I mean? So that the blueberries offset." I won't go into all the details of that, but I took one and I put it in my mouth and I began chewing and I swallowed and ate the blueberry muffin. And she just stood there with the platter looking at me like I had done something strange. She said, "Would you like another one?" I said, "Sure." So I took another one. I inserted it in my mouth. I chewed it up. I swallowed. And again, she just stood there looking at me like I was from a different planet or something. And so I said to her, is there something wrong? And she said, "You took the whole thing and put it in your mouth with one bite." I said, "Didn't you tell me these were bite-sized muffins? Isn't that the language you use? Didn't I hear you say bite-sized?" She said, well, yeah, but no. I said, "Could you show me how it's done?" So she took one of the bite-sized muffins, and she took a little bite. She chewed for a while. I think her pinky was sticking out or something. She took another bite, another. It took her 3 bites to eat a bite-sized blueberry muffin. And she was just looking at me with, it was incrimination in her eyes. She was just looking at me like, that's the way it's done. And I said, can I have another? And she said, yes. And I took one. I inserted the whole thing in my mouth. I chewed it up and I swallowed it. It was a bite-sized blueberry muffin. Now, the reason I tell you that this evening is because I've learned over the years that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are big bite people and there are little bite people. I don't know if you're a big bite person or a little bite person, but I'm going to ask you tonight to take a big bite of data, of information. I'm going to try to make it as easily accessible as possible, and we're going to have it on the screen, most of it, so that we can process at a very high rate. But I'm going to ask you to take in, to assimilate, a lot of ideas. Now, in order to get where we're going tonight, we need to take a look at this guy. Well, not him in particular, but anybody with hair like that and confidence has got to have something important to say. This is Malcolm Gladwell. He's incredible. He's written a number of best-selling books, but The Tipping Point is my favorite of all of his books. It is an incredible piece of work. What Malcolm Gladwell is tracing and helping us understand in The Tipping Point is something very fascinating. He describes it like this. He says, the tipping point is that magic moment when an idea, a trend, a social behavior crosses, what's that word? A threshold. It crosses a threshold. It tips, spreads like wildfire. So this is a phenomenon that happens in all social structures, and this is something that Gladwell thinks is important. The tipping point concept has implications for all levels of human interaction. Now, he goes on and he says this. He says, look at the world around you. And as you look at the world around you, he says, it may seem like an immovable, implacable place. I mean, we're watching and experiencing the world in real time, and so if you pay close attention, like watching the time, for example, it seems to be pretty changeless. Not a lot seems to be happening from second to second, from moment to moment, but Gladwell says of this illusion that the world is changeless, that it's implacable, that not a lot happens, it's immovable. He says, it is not. The fact is, with the slightest push, he says, in just the right place, now he's talking contextually here about social trends, markets, economies, politics, military conflict, the slightest push, sometimes in the form of a sentence spoken by one political leader to another, will tip nations to war. And so he's saying the world is more fragile than we think, and the fact is that any given little push oftentimes can push the world in a direction that had been an accumulated bunch of little effects to produce a big effect. So there are a number of micro tipping point trends that we witness in the world, for example. Some of these are interesting, comical, and cute. These are small, insignificant things that we all witness, like Beatlemania, where people just overnight with I Want to Hold Your Hand went absolutely ape mad over a British rock group. That was a tipping point in human sociology. And then there's fat ties and skinny ties. We've all watched that. If you're over 40, you've watched that trend. You've watched fashion move. There's bell bottoms. Does anybody remember bell bottoms? There's bell bottoms, and then there are skinny jeans. And I just want to pause right here and say, if there are any dudes here who are considering getting some skinny jeans, please see me afterwards, give me an opportunity to talk you out of it, to get to the root of the childhood trauma that's driving you in that direction. Skinny jeans do not look good on dudes, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. Then there's the personal computer with Steve Jobs and his crew. And now we can't imagine the world without smartphones. I mean, it's incredible. The technological revolution has put within our hands, the palm of your hand in my hand, there's more processing power for information, just sheer processing power in a smartphone than there was in the entire technological venture that put the first man on the moon. In the palm of your hand for sheer processing power. And then there are macro tipping points that we witness down through history and in society. These are trends that are large in their significance. They impact the world, quality of life. They really do tip the world, and these are major, like the Enlightenment. Whether we spend any time processing what happened back then with those people hundreds of years ago when they stepped over a line and said, wait a minute, we're not going to be dominated and controlled anymore by popes and kings. We're not going to be told what to think and how to feel. We're going to think and feel for ourselves, and we're going to become literate and begin reading. And the Enlightenment gave to the world a tipping point that produced all kinds of outcomes that you and I are enjoying this very day. Everything from the engineering that produces a building like this, which emerged out of that Enlightenment period when the average Joe or Jolene could, through study and through self-advancement, become an engineer, so that people started building buildings like only the church could build, but on a smaller scale, for their dwellings and for their markets. It used to be that everybody lived in squalor except for popes and kings. But the Enlightenment changed the whole world. It was a major tipping point. And then there was the Industrial Revolution that built railroads across the United States of America, as well as road systems. And we take it for granted, whether we even spend 5 minutes contemplating the figures, the characters, the personalities that thought at those times with a convergence of ideas that tipped the world in the direction of invention. The Industrial Revolution, we're all benefiting from it this very moment. There's the Technological Revolution. And we spoke about smartphones and all the other technology that surrounds us. The telecommunications revolution, some people would say, has changed the world more than any other factor in the last 100 years. Why? Because information made available to the masses automatically has the effect of producing a collective corporate increase of quality of life. Those who are in the telecommunications field, these individuals have given a priceless gift to the world in the form of information. My wife says to me nearly every day when I ask questions, ask Google, she knows everything. The fact is that you can literally access all the information in the world that just a mere 50 years ago was only accessible, only available to high-level academic people and scientists and politicians, and now it's at your fingertips and mine. These are major tipping points. There was the social media revolution that some of us are wishing would just go away because everybody is on Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and Instagram, and we're not getting a lot of eye contact anymore. But nevertheless, major tipping point. There was the 2008 economic crisis, where by some estimations, I mean, think this through, the entire world economy nearly came crashing down around our ears because of the decisions of a mere approximately 50 human beings who pushed the buttons necessary, not necessarily in the moment deliberately, but produced a series of trends economically by the choices they made that nearly brought the whole world to its knees. And then there was the Rwanda genocide. This is an example of a horrific tipping point where suddenly words were spoken between tribal members to other tribal members, and the machetes came out, and you know the story. And then there was the Holocaust, which we're all very familiar with, how overnight, because of some economic setback in Germany, a man was able to rise to the front of the political scene and say, we need to make Germany great again. That was not intentional, but somebody just came to the front and said, we need to be on the top again. We need to dominate again. We need to be in control again. And Hitler was able to rise and to dominate pretty much overnight in the larger scheme of history a people group and lead them to do horrific, dastardly deeds, which after the war, when they were interviewed, they said, I have no idea why we did those kinds of things. We did it because we were told to do it by those in authority. That was the only answer that could be given. Now, Matthew 24 is a chapter in the Bible that is of extraordinary significance. Now, if you're not familiar much with the Bible, that's fine. I'm not even concerned right now with whether or not you take it seriously, because in fact, I'm a person who for many years did not take the Bible seriously. I had it on the level of literature in my mind. It was categorized, it was like with Shakespeare and the Greek myths and Dickens and even Jane Austen. I thought, the Bible's in that category, all right? It's literature. But I'm going to show you some things this evening and over this week and into the weekend that I believe will absolutely blow your mind, as these things blew the mind of this agnostic slash atheist that stands before you here tonight. The fact is that there are extraordinary things brought to view, as we learned last night. Now, you were here last night, and I could see in your eyes that you were experiencing a number of aha moments, and there was a general look of wow on your faces. Is that really there in the Bible? Sure enough, it is. We saw last night that the Bible foretold 2,500 years of human history in advance. And that's with no tendency to conspiracy theories, because I'm a skeptic by nature. That's a bare minimum of the obvious of what we looked at last night, without a stretch. Now, Matthew 24 is another mind-blowing passage of Scripture. I'm just going to read it through with you right now. So we're just going to take in the passage, and then we're going to back up and begin moving through it, and notice that, in fact, Jesus, some 2,000 years ago, saw and foretold the very time in which we live and what we would be experiencing. So let's just read the passage. Now, as he, that's Jesus in the passage, sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. And they pulled up close with Jesus and they said, hey, tell us, when will these things be? These things are, Jesus had just said, there's going to be some serious stuff going down in human history. He had just said that. And they said, well, tell us, when? He said what? And they want to know when. Are you tracking with me so far? Okay, so Jesus just foretold some crazy stuff that is going to happen, not crazy as in unbelievable. And they said, but tell us, when will these things be? And then they said, what will be the, and what's that word? Say it out loud, because we're trying to learn something tonight. We're in school tonight, okay? What will be the sign of your coming, comma, check this out, and of the end of the world? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? Now, they asked for a sign, singular, if you're tracking with the grammar here. What will be the sign, singular? And then Jesus proceeds not to give them a sign, singular, but a whole list of signs. We'll just read the passage and we'll notice at least eight of them. And Jesus answered and said to them, in answer to their question, when and what will be the sign? Take heed, that means listen up. That's old King James got all involved in giving us this Bible, and we got to interpret some of the way that brother used to talk. Take heed. What Jesus is literally saying here in the Greek, the original language, is he's saying something like, sit up and take notice. Take heed. Listen carefully. Pay attention. That's what the Greek says, all right? Take heed, Jesus says, that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming to be what exactly? Saying, I am the Christ. And they will deceive many people. So there's a sign. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now, please follow. Don't sit there like I would be inclined to do and be all skeptical and say, come on, Jesus, really? The sign of the end? Wars and rumors of wars? There's always been war in human history. Can't you do any better than that? Well, that's a good question. And Jesus is about to answer it. Wars and rumors of wars? And he says, see that you're not troubled by what I've said so far. For all these things must come to pass, but the end isn't yet. So wars and rumors of wars, lots of deception, people rising up claiming to be Jesus. Just Google that. There's one guy right now on the planet who has some 300 million followers who all believe he's Jesus. Go figure. It was foretold. See that you're not troubled, for these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Then Jesus continues. For, not just wars and rumors of wars, but nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be, check this out, famines, pestilences, plural, earthquakes, plural, in various places. And this line is crucial, verse 8. And these, Jesus says, are, notice the language, the beginning of sorrows. Everybody, note that language, beginning of sorrows. Pull those words out of the passage right now. Tuck them away in your memory. Put them in your pocket. We're coming back to those words. They're crucial, and you'll see why. And they will deliver whoever they are. They will deliver you up to tribulation to kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and will betray one another, relational breakdown here, and will hate one another. There will be many false prophets who will rise up and deceive many. False prophets are false teachers. In other words, there will be a proliferation of religions and philosophies. Last count, something like 2,000 different truth claims. I've got the truth. I've got the truth. Listen to me. I'll tell you the real deal. There's going to be a lot of that going on, a lot of confusion. How are you going to sort it all through? And because, notice this language, because lawlessness will, say that word out loud, abound. We're coming back to that word. The love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end will be saved. That word saved is sozo in the Greek. It's delivered or liberated or protected through this process of all of this mayhem and craziness that's going to go down in the world. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world, some kind of global movement here, as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. Now, what have we noticed here? Let's just summarize so that we're good students here. Let's collect our data. Signs of the end, there are a number of them. We're just going to name eight of them. Jesus said, number one, there would be false Christs and false prophets, false teachers, people making a lot of truth claims. There would be wars and rumors of wars that would escalate to the point where big-time nations are rising against nations, not just internal tribal squabbles, but it's going to go to the level of international conflict. There will be famines and pestilences, earthquakes, lawlessness will abound, love will grow cold, and the gospel will be proclaimed on a global scale. So did you collect all those with me? That's all in the passage. Now, you remember I told you to put something in your pocket. Tuck it away in your memory. These things, Jesus says, are the beginning of sorrows. Now, let me show you another Bible version that more closely approximates what the Greek actually says. The New International Version, The scholars here looked at the Greek words and they said, what does that mean? And literally, the Greek language means these are the beginning of birth pains. Okay, let's pause and think this through. Jesus is delineating all these things that are going to go down in human history as signs of the end. And he says, now, these things that I'm telling you, they're going to operate like birth pains. Now, none of the men can answer this question. Don't act like you know more than you do. You know nothing about birth pains, so shut up. Don't even raise your hand. But the women here, they know some things about birth pains. What are the two characteristics of those birth pains when they start? We call them contractions, and they have two characteristics. Women, if you've forgotten, you can Google it. What is it, if you remember, there are two characteristics of birth pains. You remember they become more and more intense and more frequent. That's right. They get closer and closer together, and they become more and more intense until you're just like, ah! Now, I was there 3 times. I witnessed the whole thing. My wife has really long fingernails. They were literally driven into my arm and my leg, and she looked into my eyes and she said, "You did this to me!" And I didn't know what to say. I wanted to comfort her, but something in me just shot back. We did it together! We both did this. But she was in pain, and they got more and more frequent, and they became more and more intense. Now, think of the genius of this. Jesus knows that there have been wars down through history. There have been pestilences, which, by the way, what's a pestilence? We don't use that word much anymore. Pestilence means contagious diseases. There's been famines down through history. You think this is all news to Jesus? No, he knows all those kinds of things have been going on down through history. So he tells us, listen, I'm gonna enlighten you. I'm going to give you the key here to understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying pestilence and famine and war and natural disasters as usual. I'm saying that it's going to spin out of control like birth pangs. It's going to become more and more, these kinds of things are going to become more and more frequent and more intense. So what are we watching for, according to Jesus? Are we watching for just run-of-the-mill terrible events? No, what we're watching for is what we might call the law of exponentiality. This is what is called by Gladwell the tipping point. Now, what is the law of exponentiality? In math and in economics, we know what it means when we speak, for example, of compound interest. We all know what that means. If you have a credit card, you know that they got you in with an offer of 2% or 4% or whatever it is. And the next thing you know, you notice that it's up to 12%, 16%. 18% interest, and you realize that this is adding up faster than you can keep up. Isn't that how it works? This is the law of exponentiality. It's when numbers escalate at an increasingly rapid speed and they multiply. This is the law of exponentiality. For example, consider what some physicists have told us regarding the law of exponentiality, and you can just do the math yourself if you have a calculator. But if you ask the question, how many times, and this is hypothetical because you can't actually physically do this, but you can do this as a mathematical experiment. How many times would you have to fold a piece of paper for it to become thick enough to reach the moon? Well, you could do it literally in less than an hour. It would take only 42 folds. Why? Because one becomes two, but then two doesn't become three. Two becomes four in exponential math. And four doesn't become five. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That would take forever. This isn't stacking single sheets of paper. This is 2 becomes 4, 4 becomes 8, 8 becomes 16, 16 becomes 32, 32 becomes 64. Are you tracking? This is so that in a mere 15 folds, you've surpassed the highest mountain on earth. In 42 folds, you've reached the moon in distance, in less than the space of an hour. That's the law of exponentiality. What about Fenway Park Stadium, where the Boston Red Sox play? It's a massive stadium. Now, hypothetically, just imagine if somebody handcuffed you at the very highest seat in the bleachers. And then you watched as somebody came with an eyedropper and put one drop of water on home base. You think, there's no danger here. And then by some kind of exponential math, imagine now that there is a process of the one becoming two, the two becoming four, etc. How long will it take for you, if Fenway Park hypothetically is watertight, to be submerged underwater? You had better get out of that handcuff in 49 minutes. You will be completely submerged underwater if you don't escape in a mere 49 minutes. But in just half that time, you feel pretty safe. Because at the point of 44 minutes, follow this, the water hasn't even filled half the stadium yet. It's just right at about half. And all it takes is one more doubling, and you're underwater. So in the last 5 minutes, you think you've got all the time in the world. I'm going to repeat that. In the last 5 minutes, you're under the illusion that you have all the time in the world. So then there's this guy, Dr. Richard Swenson, who understands the law of exponentiality and the tipping point concept, but he understands it with regards to social trends, political trends, etc. In his book, Hurling Toward Oblivion, if you can't read that, the cover is designed on purpose by the designers for oblivion to be all kind of squiggly and weird looking. Hurling Toward Oblivion, Dr. Swenson says this. Now follow this carefully. He says this, he's just observing the world. And he's looking and he's comparing social trends, political trends, economic trends, and he says the world is spinning out of control and approaching what he's calling here the threshold of lethality, the threshold of death, a point where life as we know it can no longer continue on planet Earth. He continues, irreversible trends, principles, and forces currently at work in the world system. That's his shorthand for economics, politics, just sociology, psychology, everything. Technology. Irreversible trends, principles, and forces currently at work in the world system are inevitably propelling us toward a cataclysmic outcome. This is not just the tipping point. This is what's being described here, the threshold of lethality. This is where he is suggesting that the sheer motion and momentum of the world's trends are taking us to a place where even at some point, even if we wanted to turn around, you just can't. Like me in San Pedro, California, where I grew up in Los Angeles, jumping on my new skateboard and going to the highest hill because I had seen it in a magazine, and getting on the skateboard and letting gravity have its way with me. And as I'm picking up speed and I'm going 10 miles an hour and then I'm going 15 miles an hour and then I'm going 20 miles an hour and I'm just feeling the wind through my long blonde surfer hair. It was incredible, by the way, that hair of mine. And as I'm going down the hill, the next thing I know, I'm going 30 miles an hour, I'm going 40 miles an hour. And now I'm not having fun anymore. I'm thinking, stop, stop, stop. I got to get off this thing. But what's the truth of the matter now? I can't get off. And I have no choice but to take the risk to see if I can ride this out to wherever the trajectory is taking me, which just happens to be an intersection with cars at the bottom. And so I dive off the board to a very, 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 very abrupt stop behind a car with its tires. Why did I tell you all that? I forgot. Okay, the point is this. There's a point at which momentum can't be reversed. Are you following me? That's what Dr. Swenson is trying to tell us. So what are some of these things that we got going on in the world that Jesus said would exponentially just go off the charts? Well, famines is one of them he mentioned, right? Do you realize what's going on right now in the world in which we live? It's out of control with regards to famine. Those who deal with these issues, quite honestly, don't know what to do to stop it, because just today, for example, just today, and I checked this, I have it in my phone because I follow World Clock, which tracks everything happening on the earth by day, by week, by month, by year. You can just watch the numbers. You can watch the population increase. You can watch deaths by every cause. You can watch everything's going by the numbers. They're just changing live. And today, just today, there were 200 and I think it was 50,000 new human beings born on the planet. And only 103,000 deaths. You do the math. It is a situation where the food production and supply simply mathematically is not keeping up with the mouths to feed. So what we got going on in the world, as Jesus foretold, right now what we're facing is 1 in 8 people on the planet are in famine. 21,000 people per day, every 24 hours, die of starvation on this planet. Many countries, not a few, do not produce food and are utterly dependent on food being brought in, and the birth rate is surpassing the food production. That's just the situation in which we live. What about pestilences and diseases? Jesus mentioned this. We all know that the number one cause of death in the United States is heart disease. Number two is cancer, right? This is a disease that is of epidemic proportions right now in the world. 50 years ago, people knew nothing about heart disease. Cancer was an anomaly. These are what we're being told are, there's language for these diseases. They're called lifestyle diseases. Why are they lifestyle diseases? Because heart disease and cancer, as well as osteoporosis and strokes and a number of other, these are lifestyle diseases in what sense? Well, these are self-imposed diseases in many cases. Now, that's not to discount the fact that there are genetics involved. That's why when you go to the doctor, your doctor will ask you first and foremost, hey, I need a family history, because we're all genetically dysfunctional and messed up. So there are genetic markers. But the fact is that right now, in 5 years from right now, in 5 years from right now, fully 50% of American children that haven't reached their teenage years will have diabetes. That's the trajectory. That's the trend that we're on. And this is lifestyle related. But we're not even talking about that. That's out of control for certain. But there's the Zika virus that we're facing that has the highest level intellects on the planet running scared. They don't know what to do or how to stop it. There's Ebola. There's AIDS, which we've been talking about for at least 20 years. There's the West Nile virus that is beyond our comprehension, and we don't know what to do about it. And then we have this other phenomenon that's occurring where we're getting stronger and stronger flu strains that no antibiotic can deal with. And so what we have taking place, for example, just check out, these are just a couple examples most recently that I just pulled today, okay? September, that's Are we in September still? This month, in London, an outbreak of super gonorrhea in the UK is so out of control that all efforts to stop it have been completely unsuccessful. And in May of this year, in the United States of America, again, the first ever case that we know of what is called a superbug. I'll tell you what that is in just a moment. And in this particular case, it was a rare form of E. coli that cannot be killed by any antibiotic known to human beings. And it was found in a 49-year-old Pennsylvania woman at an airport. These superbugs are bugs that have become resistant, like cockroaches in Texas that just bathe in that poison that the bug killer dude comes around and sprays your house, and the cockroaches are like, bring it on. They grew up in that stuff. It doesn't kill them anymore. And that's what's happening with pestilences. Our drugs don't work anymore to deal with some of these super bugs that we're just going to have to ride it out like that skateboard down that hill in San Pedro, because there's no turning back. These are super bugs. What about earthquakes? Come on, people. Just do a little bit of research and it will blow your mind what's going on planet Earth with regards to earthquakes. Just the physical terra firma under our feet, beneath the surface, it is going in a direction that scientists don't know what to do about it. It's estimated that there are several million earthquakes every year. Several million. Most of them happen in places around the world that we don't know they're happening, but they're being measured from time to time, and the math is being done. But check this out. We measure 50 earthquakes a day on planet Earth, where there are population bases. That's 20,000 earthquakes annually taking place on planet Earth. Let's not forget how deadly earthquakes can be. December 26th, 2004, you can probably remember where you were, on some treadmill watching the news or something, or sipping tea at a cafe, and boom, the news was full of it. A tsunami, which was caused by a massive earthquake at the ocean floor, an earthquake so massive that in a matter of a day, it killed 300,000 people. Jesus said, watch for that kind of thing. Not just a tremor here and there, not earthquakes as usual, but Jesus said, watch for this thing to be like more and more frequent and more intense, like birth pains. What about natural disasters just in general beyond earthquakes? This is astounding. This is a prophecy not by Jesus, but tucked away back in the Old Testament by the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah prophesied and said, watch this, the earth mourns, very poetic. There's a lot of metaphors here, but you'll get what's being said here. The earth mourns and fades away. The world languishes and fades away. The haughty people, proud, arrogant people of the earth languish. What's going on here? The earth is also defiled under its inhabitants. What does that mean? That the practices of human beings are impacting the earth itself. Why? Because they have transgressed the laws, not arbitrary laws, but the laws of nature. They have changed the ordinance. This is a direct reference to the writings of Moses for Isaiah, where Moses gave farming practices, ordinances for farming that would be what we call sustainable farming practices, so that you would have highest yield and most luscious fruit and biggest produce if you follow these certain, if you treat the land right, the land will treat you right. And that's what Isaiah is referring to. He's saying that the earth is defiled under the weight of human transgression of the laws of nature, and they've changed the ordinance. And notice this language, they have broken the everlasting covenant. which is biblical speak for, they have broken the reciprocal law of love. They have broken the law of giving and receiving. They're raping the earth and their relationships with selfishness without giving anything back. They're taking and taking without replenishing. That's what it means to violate, to break the everlasting covenant of other-centered, self-giving, replenishing love. I'll say more about that in a moment. Therefore, now watch where Isaiah goes. He says, therefore, the curse has devoured the earth, and those who dwell in it are desolate. This is talking about the breakdown of the very system of the world. And then Isaiah says this. This is going to blow your mind. When it shall be thus in the midst of the land among the people. Oh, wait a minute. He was prophesying. He was describing what would happen in the future. Now he says, after describing it, when it shall be thus in the midst of the land among the people, it shall be, the world will be, it will be like the shaking of an olive tree, like the gleaning of grapes when the vintage is done. Again, this is highly symbolic language. It's metaphor. Essentially, what the prophet is saying is that when you see human beings living in such a way as to literally begin to break down the earth and to violate principles of sustainability, when people begin to live like that and the system begins to break down, it's going to be harvest time, like an olive tree, like grapes that can now be picked. What's the idea here? The world's over. This is the big, colossal harvest of the earth that the Bible talks about later in the book of Revelation, chapter 14. This is Isaiah saying, when people begin to live like that, you can know that it's the end. Right now, these are the facts, 150 to 200 species of plants, insects, birds, and mammals become extinct every 24 hours on this planet. Today, it will happen. I just got the news from a friend of mine who's from Africa. He said he just came to visit from South Africa. He had tears in his eyes. He said, man, we just got the news. They've done the count. It's not going to be another year, maybe 2 years max, and there will not be a rhinoceros on the planet. Just one species after another, as many as 200 per day, gone, forever gone. We are now approaching one of these tipping points, and our future is like that of passengers on a small pleasure boat sailing quietly above the Niagara Falls, not knowing that the engines, the system, is about to fail. And we're just going to go straight over. Jesus said there would be wars and rumors of wars and national conflict. Okay, but there's always been war. But do you realize what's going on in the world now with regards to war? I just checked today. I did a test. There are right now in the world, there are 10 major wars underway right now on planet Earth. By the way, the United States is involved in all of them in one way or another. But there are 10 wars going on the planet right now and 64 lesser conflicts going on around the world between nations right now, this very day. What part of the United States playing it? I'm not against the United States. I love the 4th of July, not just for the fireworks, but I just really am glad that we are free from the British. I don't know about you. But I feel that in my bones. Okay? So I'm an American. But here are the facts. The United States is the world's largest arms dealer right now, and has been for some time, controlling approximately 31% of the world's weapons markets. The U.S. supplies 94 other nations with their military weapons. So the 10 wars that are going on right now in the world and the 64 lesser wars that are going on right now, they're not using slingshots and spears. They're not using revolvers.
The United States is behind the scenes supplying the weapons for all of those conflicts that are going on. In 2015, the United States sold more than $46 billion worth of weapons to foreign markets. It is, without even a close second, the biggest business on earth. Most nations of the world have military bases in their own countries. That makes sense, right? There are a few nations that have military bases in other countries, just a few. For example, Great Britain has 16 military bases outside of Great Britain. France has 15 military bases outside of France. Russia has 9 military bases outside of Russia. The United States has over 600 foreign military bases. 600. The United States of America is, without question, the largest, most powerful, most wealthy financial war machine in the history of mankind. Now, Jesus said, what? Do you remember? There will be wars and rumors of wars. And then what did he say? Don't be concerned because it's going to get worse. Nation will rise against nation. And then what did he say? Just war as usual? He said, no, no, no. This is going to be like a woman with birth pains. And we identified the two characteristics of birth pains. And what are they? Women, men, you're not allowed to speak. What are the two characteristics of birth pains? They become more and more intense and more frequent. And that's what we see taking place with war. The military-industrial complex, as it has been termed, of American imperialism is not the last best hope of the world. I'm here to tell you tonight that there's a whole different set of principles that are sustainable that we can look to. But let's look at this one final sign. This is going to blow your mind. You remember what Jesus said regarding moral collapse as one of the signs of the time? You remember what he said? He said that lawlessness would do what? It would, I told you to hold on to that word, didn't I? Abound. That lawlessness would abound, and simultaneously what would happen? Love of many would grow cold. But whoever endures to the end will be saved. What about that word abound? Abound. It is a Greek word that refers to the very concept that we began with, the law of exponentiality, or as Malcolm Gladwell called it, the tipping point. Compound interest paid, not only financially and economically, but compound interest paid militarily, politically, socially, psychologically. The fact is that Jesus told us that lawlessness would abound, by which he meant it will exponentially surge off the charts, and the world is going to become a place that you can't even imagine. Now, I got this years ago, and it's a little funny, but not, but it makes the point in short form. In 1940, the top 7 problems in schools in the United States of America were talking out of turn, chewing gum in class, making noise in class, running in the hallways, shame on you, cutting in line, dress code infractions. What's a dress code? I've never heard of that. And littering. These were the top 7. In 2016, the same school system tells us that the problems, top 7 problems in their order, are illegal drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, pregnancy, suicide, rape, and assault. Boy, things have changed like birth pains. It's getting worse and more worse. It's getting bad and badder, and it's going to become baddest. Don't look all that up. None of those are words except for bad. Jesus foretold in this passage that the world will be overtaken by a pandemic of self-centeredness. That's essentially what he's saying. Lawlessness will abound. People will become almost universally narcissistic. The world will become increasingly and increasingly more and more egocentric. And the self will become the center for each individual. Lead, follower, get out of the way. I'm coming through. I'm moving to the top. Look out for number one. And who does he happen to be? Me. That's the world Jesus described. But know this, the Apostle Paul commented, following in Jesus' own words and Jesus' prophecy, Paul said, but know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. What will make them perilous, Paul? What will make them perilous times? For men will be lovers of who? Themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, there it is again, unforgiving, slanderers, without, check this out, without natural affections. We are witnessing in our world an almost universal decline in empathy. People can't feel one another anymore. We can literally witness murder and rape and theft, as I just personally, in New York City for the last week, heard on the news while I was there, with cameras out, people on their cell phones, just taking pictures of people being mugged and brutalized so they can upload it to their social media because they got the photo, they got the footage, rather than intervening to protect and deliver the person being accosted. Empathy is being drained out of humanity faster than it can be replenished. The fact is, people are becoming lovers of self more than lovers of God. Haughty lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. I'm just going to comment on this ever so briefly. Lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, while having a form of godliness and denying the power thereof. Last polls show that the United States of America still regards itself as a Christian nation, with 70% of the population professing godliness. I believe in God, I believe in Jesus. You've got everybody from Madonna to Lady Gaga thanking Jesus for the awards they're receiving for their licentious music videos and lyrics. The whole thing has gone so far south that we hardly know anymore where moral true north is, because everything has become normal by practice in front of our eyes, because through familiarity with anything, or if you add a little bit of comedy to it, everything becomes acceptable. So this is the world in which we live. Moral decay. You've got people, and this is not a criticism of any of these people, they just happen to be vocal about their worldviews. You've got Scarlett Johansson, you've got Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith, you've got Ethan Hawke, you've got Shailene Woodley, is that her name? These are all individuals that are very prominent in our world right now, and they are very vocal regarding their worldview. It's a new worldview, and they regard themselves as sexual omnivores. I'll just pause right there so you can think about the language and figure out what that means. Got it? No? Okay, don't try to get it. Okay, so you've got Dr. Christopher Ryan, for example, in one of the most popular TED Talks that's ever been delivered. The thing has been watched over and over again. He is the author of a book, Sex at Dawn. This book and his TED Talk lecture basically is saying that based on evolutionary theory, human beings are not monogamous creatures. So don't expect your husband to be faithful. Don't expect your wife to be faithful. Ain't gonna happen. And you shouldn't be bummed about it either, because we're just made in such a way that it is inevitable that we will violate our vows. Because in fact, Dr. Ryan tells us, we shouldn't be making any vows. That is a social and cultural construct, this idea of vows. Vows? What are those? Don't promise to be faithful to somebody. There's no reason to be faithful. You're an animal. You're an evolving animal So just follow your instincts and do whatever it is that your body dictates. That's the new light. And we're faced with what is being called the tender revolution. The tender revolution, in an article in Vanity Fair, September 2015, the article was titled "Tinder and the Dawn of the Dating Apocalypse." Now, follow this very carefully. This is all very, very current. This is very now. Now, I don't know if anybody in this room knows what Tinder is. I would think it'd be great if you were just blissfully ignorant of what Tinder is. But it's so innocent. It's just an app on your phone. That's all it is. And you just click on the app, and you set a radius. You can set a radius of a block, the building you happen to be in with a bunch of people in a restaurant or a bar or a club. You can set the radius for two blocks. You can set the parameter for a mile, a neighborhood, a city, a country, and then once you've set your radius, you click and you just start looking at faces. And if you go left, you're saying, not interested. If you swipe right, interesting. I'm interested. If that person swipes right, you hook up. Now, what this means, according to the Vanity Fair article, and this is just astounding, the Tinder revolution, these are secular journalists who have no religious interest whatsoever, and they just went into New York clubs, and they snapped photos, and this is what they saw. These are people, young people in their 20s and 30s, who are all on their phones. And the journalists are going around saying, what are you doing? You're in a group, but everybody's on their phone. And they're all on Tinder, swiping left, swiping right. And why are they doing this? Well, as the article tells us, everyone is drinking and peering into their screens and swiping on the faces of strangers that they may have sex with later that evening. Or not, if you just swipe left. Sex has become so easy that I can go to my phone right now and no doubt I can find somebody to have sex with this evening, probably before midnight, quote unquote, from one of the guys in the club. There is no dating. There's no relationships, says Amanda, one of the girls in the club in New York. They're rare. What? Relationships, dating. It's rare. You can have a fling that could go like 7 or 8 months, and you could even actually have someone be your boyfriend. You could call him your boyfriend. You're just hooking up. Hooking up is a lot easier, though. This is her point. No one gets what? Hurt. Well, she pauses, Amanda does. No one gets hurt on the surface. So there's a truth that she knows in her intuition that this hooking up thing is easier than dating because you don't have the hassle of a relationship with someone, but you have the benefit of the physical relationship, the sex, and then you can just walk away. And you're not supposed to get hurt, but you do. Another article in the New York Magazine, October 18, 2015, called it the hookup culture, and it is almost universal now throughout Western nations. And what is hookup culture? Hookup culture is meaningless sex with strangers, by definition in the article. The script goes something like this. It's a ritual. First you have sex, and then you date. The whole thing's been flipped around. Or more likely, you just continue to hook up with him or her or someone else or someone else. What's being described here is the idea, check this out, Jesus saw this. Jesus foretold this. What's being described here is a world in which people are having sex without love. You don't have to hassle with the potential of getting hurt. So Jesus said, look for it. It's going to happen. Love, and Paul said, natural affection is going to grow cold as lawlessness abounds. The article goes on to describe a situation in which some young people on college campuses are starting to notice what this leads to, and this is astounding, at an all-time high on university campuses in America right now, a whole bunch of young adults are opting out of sex and becoming voluntary virgins. Why? Because they're getting hurt because something in them is wired for love as a full-orbed relationship that includes faithfulness. And they know in their experience that sex without love isn't love at all. So the sexual freedom revolution is backfiring in the worst way imaginable. It's killing the human capacity for the emotional dimension of love. One person after another in those journalists' articles are saying it's impossible to have a relationship anymore because it's all short-term hookups, which brings us to the final sign. Jesus said all that's going to happen. Exponentially, it's going to go out of control like a woman with birth pains. The tipping point's going to come. What did Dr. Swenson call it? The threshold of lethality. The point of no return. Jesus said it's all going that way, and then he said there's a final sign. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But here's the part that we didn't emphasize. But, that's a grammatical qualification. But he who endures to the end will be saved. Now, the grammar here is very specific. Please notice what Jesus is saying. Lawlessness is going to abound exponentially. Love is going to grow cold, but there will be people who will endure in what? Contextually, grammatically. They will endure in love. There will be people who will, while the world is ceasing to love and becoming more and more jaded and hard and self-centered, there will be people who will endure in love. They will continue to love. They will grow in the capacity of their sensitive human nature in the image of God. There will be people who will navigate this crazy world in such a way that they will continue to be human and resist the trend to become animals. That's what Jesus is telling us. And then the final sign, and this gospel grammatically is what here? The gospel of enduring love. The good news that you don't have to go with the system down in flames. The good news of a love that is sustainable by the grace of God. This gospel of enduring love, this gospel of the kingdom of Jesus will be preached on a global scale, Jesus says. And it will be a witness to the world. The world will see a contrast. A witness is a testimony. It's not a lot of talking, although we do talking. You came here tonight, we're doing a lot of talking, or at least I am. There's a place for that in order to educate us and to help us grasp what's going on in the world and in ourselves. There's a place for preaching, but it's not just preaching. It's a witness. It's a testimony. It's a way of life. People are going to look on and they're going to see the world and the way it is spinning out of control and how the world is being drained of empathy and natural affection and love, wars and rumors of wars. The whole thing is going crazy, and the world will see by contrast people, a unique spectacle. There will be some people who will keep on loving others. There will be some people who will maintain the dignity and nobility of our God-given humanity. There will be those who will keep on loving straight through to the end, and it will be a testimony that will attract people who are tired of the system of consumption, the system of materialism, the system of draining, jaded lovelessness. And there will be people who will be drawn because, in fact, according to the gospel, according to the good news, love is the only eternally exponential and sustainable reality going. And only those who, by God's grace, give themselves over to the love of God in Christ, only those people will navigate through the world, straight through, and emerge on the other side of the nightmare with their hearts and their lives intact by the love of God in Christ. Thanks for your time this evening. Jamie?
It's awesome to see how much God loves us by what he shares with us down through the corridors of time, isn't it? When I read through these different texts and I hear and we study these things together, the biggest thing that I see over and over is that God loves us so much that he wanted to give us a heads up as to what we were going to be looking for. We're going to be looking at some more really interesting topics coming up. Tomorrow night is a topic that you don't want to miss. There are things in the Bible that are, we probably shouldn't have favorites, but I have favorites. There are some favorite chapters in the Bible, and tomorrow night we're going to be looking at one of my favorites, and it's going to be a really, really interesting study. So I want to be sure and invite you to come back here tomorrow night at 6:30. Then looking forward in our schedule and our studies, so Friday night, 6:30. Saturday morning, we'll be studying at 10 o'clock and 11:15 a.m., so that will be the one difference in our regular 6:30 in the evening meeting. So Saturday morning, 10 o'clock and 11:15. Then Sunday, we will be going back to 6:30 p.m. right here. Then we will have Monday and Tuesday off, and then we'll be going back in and continuing on studying next Wednesday as well. So just to give you a little bit of a heads up as to the schedule for some of our future Bible studies, that is what they will look like. So we will jump into more studies tomorrow night, 6:30. Please bring your Bible and a pen to underline with, and bring a friend to come and join. Or an enemy, he says. If you enjoy these things, I'm sure you might know somebody who would enjoy them as well. And so bring somebody along that you think would enjoy them. Again, tomorrow night's going to be a great topic, and you're not going to want to miss that. We have some refreshments for you in the back. Please stay around for a little bit. Introduce yourself to someone that you don't know and make a new friend. We'll see you tomorrow night at 6:30. God bless, and have a good evening.